Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. After a missile attack near the airport in Lviv in western Ukraine early on Friday, UN humanitarians warned that the situation across the country remains dire as Russia's military invasion continues. Now in its fourth week, the war in Ukraine has seen 44 attacks on healthcare throughout the country, including on buildings and a warehouse, patients, staff and supply chains, resulting in 12 confirmed deaths, according to WHO or World Health Organization data. Despite the dangers, the UN and its partners have continued to push for humanitarian access. Underscoring the deadly danger to civilians unable to escape Russian bombardment, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, described the situation in cities such as Mariupol and Sumy as extremely dire, with residents facing critical and potentially fatal shortages of food, water and medicine. In the country's eastern regions, needs are becoming even more urgent, said UNHCR spokesperson Matthew Saltmarsh, where more than 200,000 people are now without access to water across several localities in the Donetsk region. More than 3.2 million people have now fled Ukraine, and millions more are internally displaced. The first injection to offer long-lasting protection against HIV is being rolled out in South Africa and Brazil as an alternative to daily medication. UN agency UNITAID announced the groundbreaking development on Friday, which it is hoped will boost HIV prevention worldwide. Developed by ViiV Healthcare and approved by the US Health Authority, the injection offers 2 months of protection against HIV. Like other HIV treatments, the antiretroviral medication works by stopping the virus from replicating in the body, effectively reducing the viral load. Although existing oral medication known as oral pre-exposure prophylaxis or oral PrEP can prevent HIV in 99% of cases, uptake's been slow and targets to reduce new infections have been missed. The reasons for this include that people with HIV fear stigma, discrimination or intimate partner violence if they take the pill every day, said UNITAID spokesperson Hebe Verhussel. And finally, UNHCR, together with 102 humanitarian and development partners, is appealing for $1.2 billion to deliver much-needed aid and protection to 2.3 million South Sudanese refugees in their host communities in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, Ethiopia, Kenya, Sudan and Uganda. After nearly a decade of conflict and despite efforts towards implementing the stalled peace agreement, South Sudan continues to grapple with sporadic violence, chronic food insecurity and the devastating impact of major flooding. The COVID-19 pandemic also strained resources, the agency said on Friday. Funding is urgently needed to help these host countries to provide food, shelter and access to essential services such as education and healthcare, added UNHCR. Governments in the five countries of asylum will be supported in their efforts to integrate South Sudanese refugees in national social service systems. Matt Wells, UN News.
Hello, did you know that food grown in Ukraine feeds 400 million people around the world? Since Russia invaded its neighbor 3 weeks ago, Ukrainians need outside help to get by. And that's where the UN World Food Programme comes in, as we'll hear. Away from Europe, this week we heard UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres implore donors for funds to help Yemen, where 2 in 3 people need aid just to survive. Myanmar's been in the spotlight too, 1 year since Tatmadaw generals staged their coup with chilling results, as we'll hear from UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet. Stay with us too for comments from Solange Bertegui-Cortez, who's taking us on a literary odyssey, as we'll hear. That's all coming up in this week's UN Catch-Up, Dateline Geneva, with me, Daniel Johnson. First, the news. War in Ukraine risks seeing 90% of the country freefall into poverty and extreme vulnerability 3 weeks since Russia invaded its neighbor. A new UN report has said, apart from the heavy civilian death toll as Ukrainian cities have been pounded by Russian shelling, the UN Development Programme, or UNDP, on Wednesday cited government estimates that at least $100 billion worth of buildings, roads, bridges, hospitals, schools and other vital infrastructure have been destroyed. 1 in 2 Ukrainian businesses have shut down completely, while the other half has been forced to operate well below capacity. UNDP warned that if the conflict drags on and if more support to the country is not forthcoming quickly, it could wreck almost 2 decades of economic progress. To help prevent these shocks and protect hard-won development gains, we need peace now, said UNDP Administrator Achim Steiner. Early UN estimates indicate that nearly 3 in 10 people in Ukraine need life-saving assistance. Based on the current direction of the fighting, 18 million people will likely be affected and more than 7 million may have to flee their homes. A funding crunch has put millions of people in Yemen at risk of catastrophe. UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has said in support of a $4.3 billion appeal to fund the relief effort in the war-torn country. Since the appeal on Wednesday, 36 donors pledged nearly $1.3 billion towards the response. After more than 7 years of war in the impoverished Arabian state, tens of thousands of civilians, including at least 10,000 children, have died, Mr. Guterres said. And he added that for millions of internally displaced people, life is a daily struggle for survival, and that their plight is getting worse.
Food rations have just been reduced for 8 million people with devastating consequences. And 1 million women and girls may lose access to reproductive health and gender-based violence services, a death sentence in a country where one woman dies every 2 hours from complications during pregnancy and childbirth due to preventable causes. I implore all donors to contribute generously.
To make matters even harder, a lack of funding has forced the UN and partners to scale back or close around two-thirds of life-saving projects. In the coming weeks, nearly 4 million people in major cities may also lose access to safe drinking water. To Myanmar, where security forces have killed at least 1,600 people and detained more than 12,500 since the military coup last year, the UN Rights Office has said. In a new report released on Tuesday warning that serious rights abuses uncovered in Myanmar may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet appealed to the international community to take concerted, immediate measures to stem the spiral of violence there. The report's findings indicate that military and security forces bombarded populated areas with airstrikes and heavy weapons and deliberately targeted civilians. Many victims were shot in the head, burned to death, arbitrarily arrested, tortured or used as human shields, said UN Rights Office spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani.
Mass killings have taken place. In July in Sagang region, soldiers killed 40 individuals in a series of raids. Villagers found the remains of some victims with their hands and feet still tied behind their backs.
At least 440,000 others have been displaced since the military takeover on the 1st of February 2021, the UN report said. A further 14 million are in need of urgent humanitarian assistance, but aid deliveries have been largely blocked by the military in new and pre-existing areas of need, the report noted. The headlines there, and now back to Ukraine, where, as we've been hearing, there are huge humanitarian needs already. After power outages and food and water shortages and discriminate attacks on supply chains, 3 weeks since the Russian invasion. Leading the relief effort, the UN World Food Programme is a major player in the logistics of emergency aid. To find out more, I spoke to Abir Atifa, a World Food Programme senior spokesperson who's on assignment in Poland for the Ukraine crisis. Here she is now.
Well, the World Food Programme and all of us are deeply concerned that families in the embattled areas of Ukraine are having greater problems finding food. We're building a massive operation to bring in large quantities of food for civilians trapped in major cities and assist others that are impacted by the conflict. WFP plans to scale up to assist 3.1 million people inside the country. The systems that feed tens of millions of people inside Ukraine are falling apart. Trucks and trains are destroyed, airports bombed, bridges fallen, supermarkets emptied, and warehouses are drained. And WFP's job is, in effect, to replace some of these broken commercial food supply chains inside Ukraine. And given the complexity of the situation on the ground and the security challenges, this is such a difficult task that takes time and effort. So to respond to many of these needs, establishing operational bases inside Ukraine, in Lviv and two other locations to supply and organize humanitarian convoys to conflict areas.
How many people are you trying to reach, bearing in mind that 6.7 million are internally displaced and 18 million are apparently affected by the conflict that's going on after the Russian invasion?
We did have an operation inside Ukraine from 2014 to 2018. After that, we closed down our offices after the food security has stabilized in some areas in East Ukraine. And since then, we did not have any presence until 2-3 weeks ago. So, of course, it's a massive operation and a massive challenge to build an operation from the ground up that is supposed to be providing food assistance inside Ukraine to around 3 million people. We're also ready to assist refugees in neighboring countries if the needs arise. So this is the big challenge for the World Food Program at the moment, which is that, you know, making sure that we're mobilizing food inside Ukraine, getting the partners that we need, opening our offices in the right locations to be close to people that will be in conflict areas.
But how safe is it for you to operate within Ukraine at the moment? Where exactly are you going?
We go where the needs are, but of course we are guided by the safety and security of staff and of our partners. At the moment, we have an office in the western city of Lviv in Ukraine, and we, from there, we're also working on establishing presence in other locations. We did have a team in Kiev, but we had to move them around because the situation was getting very intense at one point, and, you know, our World Food Program colleagues had to leave Kiev and go to other locations.
Are you working with other UN agencies? Because, of course, the World Health Organization is really worried about healthcare workers and the lack of medical supplies. I mean, it would make sense to do so, wouldn't it?
Of course, we work all under the UN flag. Interagency convoys are being negotiated to get into conflict areas. So we are one team and everything will be mobilized under the UN flag. We're extremely concerned about some of the difficult situations, be it the lack of medical supplies or food supplies or water in some of the embattled areas.
And just staying with those embattled areas, the areas that are being bombed, Mariupol is the one that most people will have heard about. They haven't had any supplies for a long time since the start of the invasion on the 24th of February. So what's the latest that you have from there, please, in terms of people's food security?
Unfortunately, all the ceasefires and the negotiations for safe humanitarian access has failed. So we haven't been able to get with supplies into Mariupol. The reports, of course, that are coming from inside is that there are a lot of food shortages, no water, no medical supplies. It's a situation that we know from experience from other parts of the world is that once you cut off supplies, you're going to see hunger, you're going to see people dying without medicine. It's not the first time we've seen that. So we can only imagine what is happening inside Mariupol.
All right, Abir Atifa from the World Food Programme. Last question to you then. We're all conscious of inflation, global inflation, and the insecurity in the markets, the commodity markets, the Russian invasion. We also know that Ukraine and Russia account for massive amounts of global wheat and maize. So presumably this has a knock-on effect on the World Food Programme's operational costs. How much do you need to keep this huge operation going?
First of all, with global food prices at an all-time high, the World Food Programme is concerned about the impact of the Ukraine crisis on food security globally, especially hunger hotspots. The consequences of the conflict in Ukraine are already radiating outwards, and we have a wave of collateral hunger that's spreading around the globe. Between Russia and Ukraine, we have 30% of the exports of wheat and some major agricultural products like all sunflower oil and sunflower seeds, gas. It is going to be massive. The impact on WFP's operation alone is that we're going to have around $71 million per month extra cost for the food that we used to procure at the same cost few months ago. Ukraine is the second largest country in terms of the food that we purchase for our operations worldwide, like in Yemen, Syria, and many of the countries around the world. This is also going to have a massive impact on the humanitarian world. We are already suffering and struggling to get enough resources to support the people in West Africa, in Somalia, in Ethiopia, in Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria. So having one more conflict on top of this already adds to our very much stretched budget.
And very last question, Abir, how much longer can the World Food Programme continue to bear that extra cost?
It's going to be difficult. If we have the donor support, we can take it longer. But of course, with the stretched budget of the donors that have also been giving quite generously for the last few years, I think it will be a big challenge.
Many thanks to Abir Atifa from the World Food Programme. We'll hope to catch up with her as the emergency unfolds and as more aid reaches the country. Now, to mull over all this, I have with us our regular guest, Solange Behetegui-Cortez. She's with me now for closing comments. Hi, Sol.
Hola, Daniel. Ich ist Dictionnaire philosophique. Voltaire said that war always brings plague and famine in its wake. This is so true, Daniel. The war in Ukraine has global consequences. In a few months, or even weeks, tens of millions of people living thousands of kilometers away from Ukraine will suffer hunger. Because Russia and Ukraine are major exporters of grain and Ukraine is WFP's second largest supplier, the Russian invasion will have an impact on the humanitarian world, in West Africa, in Somalia, in Ethiopia, Afghanistan, Syria, and Yemen. What we do here has an impact there, and vice versa. Actions and solutions must be coordinated, and more than ever, we need multilateralism as our only flag. In war, human beings sometimes transform themselves and do things that they regret later. In the Odyssey, Ulysses and his crew become trapped on the island of the sun god Helios, where they run out of food. Ulysses remembers the warnings he had been given by Circe and the blind prophet Tiresias about not touching the cattle, even in the worst moments of hunger. But his men despair, and Eurylochus says to them, "Listen to me, all deaths are bad enough, but there is none so bad as famine." The men agree with him and slaughter the sacred cows. They feast for 6 days, but on the 7th day, Zeus sends a terrible storm into the ship's path, pitching the sailors into the sea, who all drown. Only Ulysses survives. Let's hope that the work that the World Food Program is doing on the ground will help to prevent men from doing irreparable harm. War and famine were for Voltaire among the worst scourges of humanity. But peace is the antidote and the best weapon against hunger.
Thank you, Sol. Peace efforts are continuing in Ukraine even while the fighting goes on. We know that the world is watching and hoping that all those who are suffering bombing, deprivation and indignity throughout Ukraine after the Russian invasion will hear some positive news soon. For the latest on the UN's work in and around Ukraine, check out the UN News website. There's also headlines, stories and interviews on other major stories from all over the world, so do take a look. That's all we have time for today. Thank you very much for listening. Sol and I will be back next week. That's right, isn't it, Solange?
Yes. See you next week, Dan.
Te veo la próxima semana. How about that? See you then. Bye-bye for now.
Ciao, Daniel.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Amid a spate of journalist killings in Ukraine, the UN cultural agency UNESCO announced that it will issue helmets and bulletproof vests to prevent further deaths. The development on Thursday follows the deaths of Fox News journalists Oleksandra Kuvshanova and Pierre Zakrzewski during shelling in Gorenka outside Kyiv on Monday. At least two other journalists have died since the start of Russia's military invasion on the 24th of February. UNESCO said that thousands of reporters are working across the country, often lacking protective equipment, particularly local reporters who have found themselves thrust into a war zone. The UN agency is supplying a first batch of 125 helmets and protective vests with press clearly marked to identify the journalists. Reporters will also be given training and advice on how to work in a conflict setting, and a 24-hour emergency hotline is in the pipeline for journalists who need to be evacuated from dangerous locations. UN Refugee Agency Chief Filippo Grandi has called for sustained international support for Afghanistan's people, where the country's humanitarian crisis is worsening. Speaking from Kabul at the end of a 4-day visit to Afghanistan, Mr. Grandi said that he'd met families who do not know what they will eat for their next meal. UN humanitarians have warned that a staggering 95% of Afghans do not eat enough, a figure that rises to almost 100% in women-only households. During his meetings, Mr. Grandi reiterated UNHCR's unwavering commitment to stay and deliver humanitarian aid to Afghanistan. He noted that decades of conflict had left 3.4 million people internally displaced and that the healthcare system is ill-equipped to withstand the COVID crisis and a measles outbreak. Key workers in schools and hospitals remain unpaid, and the country's liquidity crisis, rising global food and energy costs, are having a devastating effect, Mr. Grandi said. The UN's top rights official on Thursday urged the United Kingdom to reconsider proposed changes to its migration policy, warning that the reforms would see vulnerable people criminalized for entering the country irregularly. The draft law was introduced in the lower house of parliament last July, but the upper house rejected its key provisions, instead recommending changes that were more in line with international standards. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet urged the government to bring the proposed legislation into conformity with international human rights law and the 1951 Refugee Convention. She also highlighted how the proposal could punish and deter people from rescuing migrants in distress at sea, potentially resulting in more tragic loss of life in the Channel. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Conor Lennon from UN News. The solutions to restoring the health of the ocean, which provides us with oxygen, food and livelihoods, are out there. And in 100 days, they'll be on the spotlight in Lisbon, Portugal, at the second ever UN Oceans Conference. The event, taking place this June, will be a critical opportunity to mobilize partnerships and increase investment to fight ocean pollution, overfishing and other challenges. Laura Quinones spoke to the UN Secretary-General's Special Envoy for the Ocean, Peter Thompson, and he began by explaining how UN Ocean Conferences came into existence and why they're important.
When we brought SDG 14 into existence back in 2015 with the other 17 Sustainable Development Goals, SDG 14, to conserve and sustainably manage the resources of the ocean, didn't really have a home. You know, it wasn't like the health SDG, which had WHO, or the agriculture one, which had FAO, and so on. So the particularly the advocates for SDG 14, who are the small island developing states and some of the coastal states and some of our allies, we said that we need some kind of discipline to ensure that the implementation of SDG 14 was on track, and if it wasn't, how to bring it on track. So that's how the first UN Ocean Conference came into existence in 2017, mandated by the UN General Assembly. And now we have the second UN Ocean Conference, which is, as you say, happening in Lisbon this year. So this is the process that keeps SDG 14 honest. And that honesty, of course, is extremely important because there is no healthy planet without a healthy ocean, as the mantra goes.
How much have we advanced in ocean conservation since the last ocean conference?
Definitely not enough. There was a target for 2020 to have 10% of the ocean covered in marine protected areas. We got to close to 8%. You know, we need to do a lot more work on this because marine protected areas are an essential part of saving the health of the ocean. Now, in the Kunming CBD COP 15 this year, you know, this is the biodiversity COP, there is a proposal which 84 countries, I think at last count, are supporting for there to be a 30 by 30 target. In other words, 30% of the planet, actually, which obviously includes the ocean, being protected by 2030. So that's a lot more ambitious than what we currently have in SDG 14.5, which is the one that sets out that 10% one. But it's one which I believe is achievable, and we're moving in that direction.
Climate change is a matter of survival, but especially when we speak about small island developing states. As a Fijian yourself, Mr. Ambassador, what would you tell to people around the world to relate to what is happening in this state?
The news is not good, and you've seen the latest IPCC report. You know, I'm a grandfather, and you know what I care about, and looking around at my friends in Fiji with their grandchildren, is the security of our grandchildren. And we understand that it's not just small island developing states, it's people living in river deltas, think of Bangladesh or the Mekong. And it's people living in cities that are built on low alluvial foundations. The security does not look good for them for a 2 to 3 degree world, which is where we're currently heading. So that's why you'll find that the small island developing states, Fiji amongst them, are at the forefront of the battle to transform our consumption and production patterns so that we don't go to that 2 to 3 degree world. 1.5, as the saying goes, 1.5 to stay alive. That's still our ambition. It's getting diminishing every day in terms of the possibility of keeping to 1.5. But we're the ones that call for that ambition to be high. Whether you're from a small island developing state or a river delta, it's a matter of survival of not just grandchildren, but of cultures that have existed for thousands of years in those locations.
What concrete actions can we take to keep 1.5 alive and protect our oceans?
Well, go to the UNFCCC COP26, see what came out of that, where we're heading for COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh in November. And, it's about cutting down the use of fossil fuels, obviously. You don't need me to tell you that. But, those coal-burning activities, every belch that comes out of every one of those chimneys is another nail in the coffin of those countries, those environments which I've just been talking about. And, let's be honest with ourselves. It's every one of us. As we come out of this COVID pandemic, are we going to just go back to what we were doing before, or are we going to try and eat more sustainably, travel more sustainably, shop more sustainably? Has the pandemic taught us a lesson? Hopefully it has, and we'll be building back not just better, but we'll be building back greener and bluer.
What do you think is hindering the progress to protect the ocean?
Well, progress for me in terms of ocean protection is all about implementing SDG 14. And that's, as I've got quite a few targets. It's about pollution. It's about overfishing. It's about the effects of greenhouse gas emissions. It's about getting marine protected areas in place and so on. First of all, I think it's very doable. I don't lose sleep on whether we're going to achieve this or not. We are going to achieve this by 2030. I think of things like SDG 14.6, to rid the world of harmful fisheries subsidies that lead to overfishing and lead to illegal fishing and so on. That is a very doable act, and the time to do it is at the WTO ministerial conference in June this year. A doable thing. And who's going to do it? The member states of this world. And if they fail, they fail all of us. Are they going to do it? I'm sure they will, because they've looked at Nairobi and saw that member states in Nairobi grasped that nettle of consensus and said, let's do the right thing by people and planet. Let's get this treaty to ban and control plastic pollution. Let's bring it into reality. They've appointed an intergovernmental negotiating committee to get that treaty up and running, they will finish their work on that by the end of 2024. So it's doable. This stuff is doable. That's SDG 14.1, by the way, which is why I'm so excited about it, because when you talk about marine pollution, which is SDG 14.1, 80% of it is plastic. So by getting this treaty in place, an internationally binding treaty in place to combat plastic pollution, we're going to hit that 14.1 target. No problem.
Do you remember any solutions, or have you seen any solutions that people are actually implementing right now to protect the ocean that you would like to highlight?
Look, there's 1,000 solutions, and a fleet of them will be launched at the UN Ocean Conference in Lisbon. But rather than going into individual ones, I would say be prepared for that fleet. One that I particularly like talking about is nutrition. We all know that the sea provides very healthy nutrition compared with some of the other things that are produced on land. We don't eat what our grandparents ate. We have a totally different diet, which is, in fact, why obesity is such a problem around the world. But our grandchildren will be eating very differently from what we eat. They won't be eating big fish, for example. They will still be eating fish, but they'll be small fish which are grown in sustainable aquaculture conditions. They'll be eating a lot more algae, and that may not sound appetizing to you, but you're already eating it in your sushi with the nori that's around your sushi. That's seaweed, right? That's algae. The biggest source of food in the world, really, is unexploited by anybody other than whales, phytoplankton. You know, they will be eating some kind of marine tofu, which is made from phytoplankton. We'll be farmers of the sea rather than hunter-gatherers, which is what we still are. It's the only place we still are, which is out on the ocean. So those sort of transformations are underway, but we have to invest in the transformations, and we have to start doing that now.
And as individuals, what can I do to protect the ocean? What can I do to support this very important thing?
I think you have to think first about source to sea, very important. I see people throwing cigarette butts into the gutter. They don't think about the fact that, you know, the filter of that cigarette is microplastics and that it's heading in one direction, which is down the drain into the sea eventually, and that's more microplastics going into the ocean. And the microplastics, of course, are coming back to them when they're eating their fish and chips because those microplastics are being absorbed into life in the ocean. That cycle is going on, whether people realize it or not. So I think source to sea really important, but that relates to our industries, to agriculture, to the chemicals that are coming down the same drains and rivers out into the sea and poisoning the lagoons that we rely on for healthy marine ecosystems. So what can we do? We can just adopt a better behavior as human beings in that regard in terms of pollution. Look at your plastic use and say, do I really need all this plastic in my life? I'm old enough to remember a world with no plastic. It was very nice, thank you. You can make your own decisions about your nutrition, but I remember my wife and I, when we were living here in New York, looking at just one more report about what beef was doing to the Amazon. And we looked at a photo of our grandchildren and said, what do we love more, hamburgers or our grandchildren? And we decided then and there, it was about 5 years ago, to give up beef. Do you need to own a car? I mean, a lot of people do need to own cars, but my wife and I, we haven't had a car. We've been living in cities now for quite a while. We haven't had a car for decades. You rely on public transport and walking, which, of course, is the best way to get around. Individuals have to make the right choices that make this world a sustainable place.
Going back to the Oceans Conference that's coming up, what's the key thing you're expecting to achieve in that conference?
You know, there's so many levels of that. And I don't know if you were at the COP26 in Glasgow, but look, the hard work that goes on in plenary of related to text, right, and agreements. But I have to be honest with you, I didn't go into plenary at all. And I was so tied up in what was happening around the outside of plenary with all these new ideas and all these side events and all the displays and so on. There was just so much to learn up there outside of plenary. So you've got the people that need to go into plenary and do the hard work on the texts and the agreements and putting their national positions. And that's a necessary part of a UN conference. But in Lisbon, we also want to generate outside of that formal process just the excitement of new ideas, of innovation, and that will be in these side events. And I'm very confident that there's going to be this innovation, which is going to be visible in that carnival-type atmosphere that you develop around that central core of the conference. Of course, science-based, innovative partnerships is the other big thing, public and private, and north and south, east and west. This is a universal moment. A UN conference is always a universal moment. And the first ocean conference in 2017 was a game changer in terms of waking the world up to the ocean's problems. I think this conference in Lisbon in June is going to be about providing the solutions to the problems that we've alerted the world to, and I'm very confident that those solutions are going to emerge when we get there.
We really, really hope so as well. UN Secretary General's Special Envoy for the Ocean, Ambassador Peter Thompson. I'm Laura Quiñones, UN News.
This is the News in Brief from the United Nations. Almost one child per second in Ukraine is becoming a refugee of the war, UN humanitarians said on Tuesday, as the total number of people who have now fled the country since the Russian invasion began passed 3 million, highlighting that 9 in 10 of those fleeing unrelenting violence in Ukraine are women and children. The UN Children's Fund UNICEF warned that youngsters are prey to traffickers as they arrive in unfamiliar new surroundings. The development follows a warning from the UN Secretary General, who on Monday said that Russia's military offensive against civilians was reaching terrifying proportions. At Ukraine's border with neighboring countries, overwhelming numbers of traumatized people have arrived, creating opportunities for criminal gangs who are known to flourish in conflicts, as UNICEF spokesperson James Elder told journalists in Geneva.
To give a sense of the border that I used to visit, the main border, Medyak, Poland to Ukraine, it is scores of people standing around buses and minivans calling out names of capital cities, or at least it was a week ago, and people getting onto those. The vast majority, of course, are people with wonderful intentions and great generosity, but there is no doubt, given what we understand of trafficking in Europe, and that remains a very, very grave issue.
Staying with Ukraine, humanitarians warned that the situation in the port city of Mariupol has deteriorated further after more heavy Russian bombardment. Hundreds of thousands of people are being suffocated by a lack of supplies and are unable to flee the city besieged by Russian forces, said the International Committee for the Red Cross, ICRC. Spokesperson Ewan Watson also confirmed that a small number of vehicles had managed to get out of Mariupol on Monday, but this was just a drop in the ocean compared with those left behind. Amid reports that families are being forced to gather water from streams and that fights have broken out over food, Mr. Watson urged the Ukrainian and Russian authorities to find a solution so that aid can reach the city's people. To Myanmar, where security forces have killed at least 1,600 people and detained more than 12,500 since the military coup last year, the UN Rights Office said on Tuesday. In a new report warning that serious rights abuses uncovered in Myanmar may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet appealed to the international community to take concerted, immediate measures to stem the spiral of violence there. The report's findings indicate that military and security forces bombarded populated areas with airstrikes and heavy weapons and deliberately targeted civilians. Many victims were shot in the head, burned to death, arbitrarily arrested, tortured or used as human shields, said UN Rights Office spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani.
Mass killings have taken place. In July, in Sagang region, soldiers killed 40 individuals in a series of raids. Villagers found the remains of some victims with their hands and feet still tied behind their backs.
At least 440,000 others have been displaced since the military takeover on the 1st of February 2021, the UN report said. A further 14 million are in need of urgent humanitarian assistance, but aid deliveries have been largely blocked by the military in new and pre-existing areas of need, it noted. Daniel Johnson, UN News. Hello. 2 weeks since Russia attacked Ukraine, more than 2.3 million people have fled the country. No easy journey, of course, but for the trans community, whose passports don't match their identities, escaping the war is proving even harder. Find out why in this week's interview with NGO Transgender Europe. We'll also hear the latest from a refugee shelter in Berlin that's now helping those fleeing the Ukraine crisis. Stay with us too to hear about how Shakespeare's Rosalind fits into the mix, with the show's co-host Solange Behetege-Cortez. That's all coming up in this week's UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson. First, the news. Starting with Ukraine, where there's been swift condemnation following Wednesday's bombardment of a maternity hospital in Mariupol, which reportedly claimed many lives, including children. Speaking out against the attack, which comes 2 weeks since the start of the Russian invasion, WHO's Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus on Thursday expressed solidarity with health workers still trying to save lives there.
In Ukraine, the health system is struggling with COVID-19 and dangerously low oxygen and medical supplies while war rages around them. I reiterate the attacks on hospitals, medical personnel, and medical transports are forbidden under international humanitarian law. Any such attacks are grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions.
to COVID-19 now, and a warning at the Human Rights Council that the global failure to deliver enough vaccines to developing countries is prolonging the pandemic and causing tens of thousands of preventable deaths every week. To date, more than 10.5 billion vaccine doses have been administered globally, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said on Thursday, but the grim reality is that only around 13% of people in low-income countries have been vaccinated, compared with almost 70% in wealthier nations. Promoting vaccine equity everywhere is a basic rights issue, Ms. Bachelet said, warning that vaccine nationalism has pushed people into poverty and made them miss out on education and development chances. Stockpiling COVID-19 vaccines is also not consistent with states' human rights obligations, she added. Also speaking at the Human Rights Council debate, UN-appointed independent rights expert Atiyeh Waris insisted that taking action on illegal tax flows would help vaccine equity. Tax dodging by wealthy individuals and corporations cost countries more than $480 billion a year, she said.
This amount would have been enough to fully vaccinate the global population against COVID more than three times over. Booster after booster after booster, and we would still be fine.
UN-appointed rights investigators this week urged renewed efforts for a political solution to Syria's devastating war amid an uptick of violence and a deepening humanitarian crisis. The latest UN Human Rights Council-mandated report on the conflict points to hundreds of thousands of civilians killed after more than 10 years of conflict, more than half of the pre-war population now displaced, and 14.6 million people dependent on humanitarian aid. In Syria's northwest, many people forced from their homes are still living in flimsy tents, stuck in snow, rain and mud, the investigators said, while in the northeast, tens of thousands of women and stateless children linked to ISIL fighters are still being held in the notorious Al-Hol camp complex. Here's Commissioner Lynn Welchman.
The conditions in Al-Hol are absolutely appalling, and the number of children and other numbers of mostly women who are detained come interned there. It's a dreadful situation, humanitarian-wise and security-wise.
The commissioners said that the camp has seen more than 90 murders and 40 attempted murders just in the past year. The headlines there, and now back to Ukraine, where, as we've been hearing, top UN officials have expressed horror and outrage over the reported destruction of a maternity hospital in the stricken coastal city of Mariupol, which has been under heavy bombardment for days, 2 weeks since the Russian invasion began. One lesser reported aspect of the crisis is the impact on the trans community, whose passports and ID cards do not reflect their gender identity. And that's a big problem when you want to leave the country but you can't, and in some cases, you're told to go and fight instead. Let's hear the latest now from Richard Koehler, Advocacy Director of Transgender Europe. It's an NGO with 183 member organizations in 47 different countries.
When it comes to the situation of trans people, and particularly trans women in Ukraine, and what they're facing, particularly when it comes to the ability of leaving Ukraine, we have actually quite some troubling reports. While we see that the situation in Ukraine is horrible for everyone, and there are so many people who really need to leave this country, at the moment we are deeply concerned of the consequences of this war for human rights in general, but also for trans people and trans women in particular. So what we're seeing is actually that already in peacetime, it was very difficult for trans people to get documentation that is reflecting their gender identity. And that means a lot of trans people do not have passports or identity documents where their appearance and lived experience is actually matching the sex on their ID. So you actually have trans women living as women, but they have so-called male passports. So that means that they are considered to be, that they have to go on duty, that they have to be drafted for the military. So they would not be allowed to leave Ukraine as other women would be allowed to leave at the moment. And we have these very troubling reports that military commissions are not accepting them, but actually sending them to fight. In this situation right now, what we're seeing, this mismatch of documents is actually increasing the risk of trans people for arbitrary arrest, for physical, psychological, sexual violence. And that makes it especially difficult for trans people to travel safely through Ukraine, let alone leave the country. So we have reports of trans people who are not even leaving their apartment, even though their whole block or area is under heavy shelling because they're so afraid.
And for those trans people who do manage to flee Ukraine, what kind of reception are you hearing that they're getting in neighboring countries?
For the moment, what we hear about experiences of trans people who make it across the border from Ukraine, there is, I would say, a network in development of LGBTI-friendly shelters along the border. In different countries, activists have put together overnight pretty much excellent resources in Poland, but also in Hungary or Slovakia, the Czech Republic or Moldova. So there's a lot of support there. And there's a lot of support also like in coming from countries further down west. So we have been seeing amazing upspring of solidarity, a lot of fundraising activities, people being ready to donate money, facilities, clothes, but also like to offer their own homes. And that we see, there have been really heartwarming stories of trans people like who left Ukraine and who were welcomed on very short notice by new hosts in a new country to help them settle down a bit and forget a bit about the horrendous things they have seen in the war.
Richard Koehler there from Transgender Europe. I also got in touch with a refugee center in Berlin where Ukrainians and third country nationals are arriving. Some are even planning on going back to the war zone, as I found out from one NGO volunteer at the shelter who asked us to keep his identity private. Here he is now.
With the Ukrainian crisis, I can say that it's a really new situation. Each new crisis brings a lot of new challenges with it, and the one that many people now have been meeting and talking to, they are already recovering from another fleeing experience. And now, after maybe settling down in Ukraine, they have to flee again. I'm talking about people who are now already flew from Syria, Afghanistan, and they found maybe what they could call a home to start a new life in Ukraine, and they have now to flee again, which is a new situation for me, at least through my experience working here.
You yourself, you're from Syria and you left the country a long time ago. So what is it that you do that really helps them in their attempt to seek shelter and sustainable shelter?
I think what really helps in this situation is to listen to what people are willing to tell. It's each person has another story, and a few of them that I maybe meet them once now in my life and will never meet them again. For me, what's important to show and give that there is someone who is really interested in you as a person. Each story, it's a story itself.
Is there one story in particular that jumps out at you from the last 2 weeks of the conflict in Ukraine?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the last one happened today. For me, I talked to that dad who's really now worried about bringing his family to another country in Europe where he has already some relatives. And he's planning to go back to Ukraine to take care of all the things he has left there because they had to flew without packing or taking the car with them. So that story, I think he just wanted to share it with someone how complicated the situation is. For him, the most important thing now, the children should be safe in another European country where he has already some relatives. And the long-term plan is not really clear. And I felt sad for this because this guy, he has already flew from another country, from Afghanistan, and now he's again in this situation that the future is not clear. And I could see that only by listening, and I couldn't give him anything right now, like just by listening and showing that this is really important. And I could somehow feel how hard and challenging this situation could be for him. Like he's really only worrying about the family. He needs to bring them to a safe point and travel back to take care of what has been left.
Yes, it's heroic, really, isn't it? Because he's already made the huge effort to come across the country, leave Ukraine in the midst of all this violence and this shelling that we're hearing about, bombardments, and now he's going to go back again. It's astonishing. But I guess the experience of meeting these people helps you provide support to those who are coming afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I've been learning every day from each story I've heard. And this story, it touched me really that there is someone who's already has done this experience already once behind him, and he has to redo it again. And this, I have so much respect for people who are willing to not give up at all and retrying. And the road he described to me, like to bring the people to another European country, later come back to Ukraine and take care of, this is a lot of work. And he was telling it to me in a very, he was sure what he was doing and telling. So this is really so impressive.
Different perspectives on the Ukraine crisis there. Many thanks to this week's guests. Now, time to mull all this over with Solange Behetegui-Cortez, our regular guest, who's with me now for some closing comments. Hi, Sol.
Hola, Daniel. The number of refugees fleeing Ukraine after the Russian invasion has reached more than 2 million, according to the UN Refugee Agency. And we just heard that many of them are living the experience for the second and even third time. It is a tragedy. When it comes to crossing a border, the color of your skin, your gender identity, or the type of passport you have can change your life. It reminds me of the famous quote by Shakespeare, "To be or not to be, that is the question." He was thinking about life and death. Richard Kohler from Transgender Europe said to you just now that trans people are only one group that is particularly vulnerable at the moment in Ukraine. If you are a trans woman with an M for male stamped in your passport, you simply aren't allowed through checkpoints. In his last report, the UN independent expert on gender issues and discrimination said that the absence of identification documents matching identity and gender expression is an immediate risk factor. He also warned that it can result in people being refused humanitarian assistance. I still have Shakespeare in my head. In 1599, he wrote a comedy about love and identity called As You Like It. The main character, Rosalind, disguised herself as a man to travel safely and unnoticed. Rosalind encounters Orlando, lovesick for his Rosalind, and promises to cure him of his lovesickness by pretending to be that very Rosalind, so that Orlando will learn something of what women are really like. In the 16th century, female characters were played by young teenage boys. So, at the theater, the public saw a man playing the role of a woman who in turn pretends to be a man. Today, 4 centuries later, Shakespeare's Rosalind cannot get across the border without suffering discrimination, arbitrary detention, and rape. But then again, that's because real war isn't theater.
Thank you, Sol. And the Ukraine catastrophe will be featuring in next week's show. We'll be hearing from the World Food Programme on its massive humanitarian operation. So do join us for that if you can. Until then, thanks for being with Sol and I today. We really appreciate your company and hope that you'll share your own catch-up as widely as you can. Bye-bye for now. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN World Health Organization, or WHO, said on Monday that it's working day and night to keep medical aid flowing into Ukraine following Russia's invasion more than 2 weeks ago. The relief effort has continued despite missile attacks on at least 24 healthcare facilities, workers and patients in Ukrainian cities, which have killed 12 people and injured 34. Another key priority of the WHO relief effort is to provide support to neighboring countries' healthcare systems amid an ongoing exodus of Ukrainians fleeing the war, which is now approaching 3 million people. Supply chains have been severely disrupted, the UN Health Agency said in a statement, adding that many distributors are not operational, some stockpiles are inaccessible owing to military operations, medicine supplies are running low, and hospitals are struggling to provide care to the sick and wounded. Some 18 million people in Ukraine are believed to have been affected by the war, including 6.7 million internally displaced. Chronic and emergency needs have stretched medical facilities to breaking point, with WHO reporting that nurses have had to ventilate patients manually in hospital basements away from Russian shelling that has been condemned by the UN Rights Chief. Among the most needed life-saving supplies, the UN Health Agency has sourced oxygen and insulin, surgical supplies, anesthetic and transfusion kits to collect, test and safely transfuse blood. Staying with Ukraine, electricity has been restored to the stricken Chernobyl nuclear reactor after power was lost following the site's occupation by Russian forces on the 24th of February. Announcing the news on Sunday, the UN Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, said that the plant's backup diesel generators could now be turned off. IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi explained that there had not been any critical impact on safety, as Chernobyl's spent fuel rods have continued to be cooled by the existing water tanks. But Mr. Grossi said that he was still gravely concerned about safety and security at Chernobyl and Ukraine's other nuclear facilities. At the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, which has been under Russian control since the 4th of March, the IAEA chief said that Ukrainian technicians had been joined by Russian representatives contravening safety directives. Yemen's already dire hunger crisis is teetering on the edge of outright catastrophe. The UN warned on Monday as new data analysis indicated potentially record food insecurity there. Today, more than 17.4 million Yemenis are food insecure. An additional 1.6 million are expected to fall into emergency levels of hunger in coming months, taking the total of those with emergency needs to 7.3 million by the end of the year. Of extreme concern to humanitarians is the likelihood that the number of people experiencing catastrophic or famine-like levels of hunger will increase fivefold to 161,000 by the 31st of December. World Food Programme Executive Director David Beasley said that we are almost out of time to avoid catastrophe, and he added that unless the agency received substantial new funding immediately, mass starvation and famine will follow.
Yes, there has to be a movement of women in capitalist countries, in communist countries, in third world countries, and in the United Nations.
That was feminist writer and American women's movement leader Betty Friedan speaking in 1975 at the UN as events for the first ever International Women's Year gathered pace toward the first historic World Conference on Women in Mexico City that June. The General Assembly set three ambitious goals for the year, promoting equality between men and women, integrating women into economic development, and strengthening peace. I'm Matt Wells here at UN headquarters in New York, 43 years on, and we're going to take you back to that moment for this edition of our podcast classic series, when the women's movement was battling male skepticism, if not aggression, and male-dominated institutions, striving to be even heard on an equal footing. Elizabeth Reid was the first ever National Advisor on Women's Affairs appointed by Australia's Prime Minister. She was blunt about the challenges facing her pioneering generation of mid-70s feminists.
I think the first thing that can be said is that women are the oldest colonised and underdeveloped group in the world.
In a moment, we'll hear from one of UN Women's in-house historians on the significance of this watershed year for the gender equality struggle. But first, here's an edited version of six special shows produced by UN Radio in early 1975, surveying the state of womankind. It's only right we credit the writers, producers and presenters Sylvia Levitan and Roger Belden.
Half the world is woman.
Half the world is woman, until now kept out of the way, but she's coming out now, has things to say, and without a doubt she'll be up and away, 'cause it's the dawn of a new day.
This is United Nations Radio, with the first in a series of programs devoted to International Women's Year, 1975. Equality between men and women was proclaimed a principle in the United Nations Charter almost 30 years ago. Over the years since, it has been spelled out and reinforced in various declarations, conventions and resolutions. But what are the realities of today?
The face of the liberated woman, the contours of her character, are a complete mystery to us. She does not exist any more than does the liberated male.
That's how the Australian feminist Germaine Greer describes the present situation. Britain's Janet Cockcroft takes it a little further.
Women's talents are not being utilised, except in small measure, in any part of the world. Nor have women and girls been generally granted equality of opportunity or treatment with men and boys.
Some of the dimensions of the problem are pinpointed by Amadou Makhtar Mbo, Director General of the UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization. We quote from a recent message of his.
Of the estimated 800 million illiterates in the world, 500 million are women. Although women make up between one-third and one-half of the workforce, the overwhelming majority of them are concentrated in low-paid jobs.
But hasn't there in fact been a great deal of progress in the last few years? The answer everywhere is yes, but, as illustrated by Father Anthony de Souza, an Indian Jesuit on the World Council of Churches.
And today we have a woman as the Prime Minister of India. On the other hand, I do grant that there are a lot of changes that have to be brought about.
Ruth Jacobi, First Secretary of the Swedish Foreign Ministry, tells what is happening.
In some countries, women are still fighting for equal legal and political rights. But even in societies that have formally granted equal rights to men and women, the struggle is far from over. Whatever UN resolutions may call for, or national laws may prescribe, economic realities, values, norms, and prejudices constitute obstacles that will take time and effort to remove.
We bring you some of the views expressed in a panel discussion of the plan of action being prepared for the International Conference, which opens in Mexico City on the 19th of June.
Mrs. Helvi Sipilä, the Secretary General of the conference, has emphasized one basic cause for the lack of action. Women have not been involved in the planning and decision-making. But this does not mean that men are completely to blame.
If women in most countries today have political rights, what have we done with these rights? Maybe we have just taken them as a right, but not as a responsibility.
Haven't women, in fact, throughout history, taken on revolutionary roles along with men, fighting with the same guns, enduring the same hardships?
How come that when the struggle is over, their companions, they send them back to the kitchens to cook their dinners and to wash their socks?
That was Italian journalist Oriana Fallaci, and here is the Argentine psychoanalyst Mari Langer.
In Cuba, for instance, they were not sent back to the kitchen. Deep down, this is a problem having to do with economic relations as well as production.
U.S. author Alvin Toffler saw the next 25 years as turbulent ones marked by a super-industrial revolution involving not only technology, but a transformation of the entire social system.
And it seems to me that the worldwide movement for a change in sex roles is a part of this historic transformation that I think will touch every conceivable aspect of our lives over the next 25 or 30 years.
But that's not quite how it seems to Elizabeth Reid, personal advisor to the Prime Minister of Australia.
It seems to me that no political revolution is ever going to achieve anything at all for women. And I must say that I totally disagree with Mr. Toffler, and that the revolution that women require is something quite different.
Nor is it the view of Germaine Greer, Australian author on women's affairs.
I'm a firm believer that one can never be liberated by anyone but oneself. But on the other hand, you can't undertake it as an individual either. It's a question of the collectivity.
But Soviet astronomer Alla Masevich stresses quite a different point.
The most important thing are the economical problem. Technology can do a lot of good, especially for women.
Until we begin to set priorities that relate to making this a human society, the whole business of economics gets us into the bag of simply acquiring more of the things that make us less human.
And that was Margaret Wilson, chairman of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in the United States. Yet another thought from Ghanaian High Court Justice Anihiaga.
In the developing countries, the problem is simply this, that women have had years of traditional attitude that affairs of state are not matters for women.
The question is how to bring women into the positions of leadership and power that will allow them to share in decision-making. Why is the Australian feminist writer Germaine Greer pessimistic about the outlook, at least for the next quarter century?
Because most of the governments who are in fact represented at the UN are characterized by having a silent majority, which is female.
But Annie Geiger is much more optimistic.
Now, it is true that at the moment, most positions of power are in the hands of men. But women are coming up, and they are breaking this down.
And Britain's Janet Cockcroft has some words of advice.
Let us remind ourselves and others that we women are not a minority group. In the United Kingdom, we have recently witnessed the election for the first time of a woman as leader of a major political party. But when the momentary elation had passed, we realized that such events should not be a 9 days wonder, but should be expected.
Some have wondered why, given the rise to power of such women as Indira Gandhi and Golda Meir, it has not yet been possible to have a female Brezhnev or Ford. Soviet astronomer Alla Masevich feels that this is not the crux of the problem.
A large percentage of women should be in the governmental work where they really can do something. For a big country, one person is nothing.
Mrs. Masevich points to the heavy representation of women in her government and emphasizes that education is the key. But Italian journalist Oriana Fallaci looks at the situation from another angle.
We all know that the vote of women is exploited, but we always forget that one reason why there are so few women all over the parliament, all over the world, is that women do not vote women. Why?
We quote here from a reply given by Madame Jean-Martin Cissé of Guinea.
We, the women, must change our own thinking. And let us start by showing far greater cooperation among ourselves.
Yes, there has to be a movement of women in capitalist countries, in communist countries, in third world countries, and in the United Nations.
That was American feminist Betty Friedan. But Father Anthony D'Souza, an Indian Jesuit on the World Council of Churches, raises another question regarding women's liberation movements.
We have to ask ourselves, not merely liberation from what, but also liberation for what. We must not think of ourselves as rivals, men and women. It has to be conceived as a partnership.
Leticia Shahani of the Philippines agrees, but raises another issue.
While we should not look on equality as something as the battle of the sexes, I think it must also be recognized that women have suffered.
With two-thirds of the world afflicted by poverty, malnutrition, illiteracy and disease, increasing attention is being given to the question of how to bring the long-neglected resources of woman power into the struggle for better conditions of life. What of the millions of women, mostly in rural areas, who know no way of breaking out of a cycle of constant childbearing and back-breaking work as they struggle for sheer survival for themselves and for their families? Father Anthony D'Souza, an Indian Jesuit on the World Council of Churches, highlights one aspect of this problem.
There are, for instance, the developing countries in Asia where the woman, as a woman, does not have respect. But as a mother, she has respect. So the attitude of the girls is to get married as soon as possible and to have a child as soon as possible. This is the thing that we have to change.
Mahnaz Afkami of Iran sums it up this way.
Development in its true sense cannot take place without the full participation of women. Women cannot, however, play their role unless there is some degree of development first, especially in relation to attitudes and prejudices.
As legal and other reforms are gradually breaking down some of the tangible barriers which have prevented women from assuming equal rights and responsibilities, another kind of obstacle, perhaps the most difficult, is being faced. It concerns attitudes. Mrs. Sandlund of Sweden gives a concrete example.
We cannot successfully claim an equal participation of women in the production and in political life and trade union activities if we at the same time are demanding women to have the full responsibility for home and children.
Mrs. Kubota of Japan agrees on the need for a more equitable sharing of responsibilities.
When both man and wife have jobs, the tendency is the wife bears greater burdens, both physically and psychologically.
This calls for a radical change in the traditions and attitudes, and a new perception of the sex and family roles in society.
And that was Ruth Jacoby, first secretary of the Swedish Foreign Ministry, who emphasizes that changes in the traditional female role imply changes in the traditional male role.
The need for these far-reaching changes applies to developed and developing countries alike.
Ghanaian High Court Justice Anijaga agrees, but she sees the struggle for equality between men and women as part of a broader commitment.
I don't think that this world will be destroyed by an atomic explosion. I think it will be destroyed by the explosion of injustice. And that is why the question of the liberation of women is so very basic, because it is a manifestation of injustice. And if it goes, other manifestations of injustice must go with it. The unjust world economic situation must go with it. The unjust racial discrimination must go with it.
And so, International Women's Year continues to engage the attention of governments, organizations, and individuals in a campaign to promote awareness and in a plan of action on behalf of equality, development, and peace. Among recent signs of progress,
Democratic Yemen has outlawed polygamy. France has a new abortion law. Mexico has approved an equal rights amendment to its constitution.
This is United Nations Radio. The song, Half the World is Woman, was written and sung by Jacqueline LeMay.
So that's where the discussion over women's rights stood in early 1975. To put it all into some kind of context and discuss how many of those hopes and aspirations have been realized today, I'm joined in our podcast studio here at UN headquarters by Sylvia Hordosh. She's a policy advisor for UN Women, the UN's agency dedicated to gender equality that in many ways grew out of the whole legacy of International Women's Year in 1975. Sylvia, we've got to start, I think, with the haunting reference we've just heard there to democratic Yemen, where in early 1975 the government outlawed polygamy. Now, of course, it's one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a woman.
Correct. This shows how progress is uneven. Some countries make tremendous progress, and then you have armed conflict, natural disasters, you name it, and the situation can change. But the fact is that since 1975, women globally have made tremendous progress.
So that's the headline?
That's the headline.
And just put into context why this year was so important. I mean, obviously, you know, we've heard just there some of the watershed moments that occurred. One event that had yet to take place when those recordings were made was this seminal conference in Mexico.
It started out with the Commission on the Status of Women celebrating its 25th birthday. And the Commission on the Status of Women is the main body within the United Nations to focus on women's rights and gender equality. And out of the Commission's work came the idea of declaring the International Women's Year, just focusing on women's rights. There was a sense for a need for an international year. And so we had the International Year declared, the first World Conference on Women in Mexico. And then there was a sense a year wasn't enough. It became a decade, became the decade for women, and then followed by the second World Conference on Women in Copenhagen in 1980, Nairobi in 1985, and then in 1995, the fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing. And the Beijing Platform for Action is still the guiding document for us at UN Women and for gender equality advocates across the world that provides us with policy recommendations in a very wide range of issues, looking from poverty, economy, health, education, media, human rights, all these issues are covered in the Beijing platform.
Was there a sense that this was the year, therefore, when women's rights really took off and women were, for the first time, not just sort of recipients of attention and policy formulations and declarations and actually became, you know, started to become equal partners in the decision-making process of bodies like the UN?
Yes, and I would also add that this is the time when you have a whole new wave of women's activisms, women's movements across the globe.
So these women were really reflecting the culture and the cultural moment that we were in 1975.
And the sense that not enough had been done, and so women were rising up and saying, we want to enjoy our rights, we want to have access to education, to the labor market. Remember 1975, there were some prominent universities in the U.S. that did not yet allow women.
There was this figure that kind of leapt out at me from the tape there, that there are 800 million illiterate people in the world. It was said 500 million of whom were women. Has that proportion got better?
Well, it's interesting. I looked that up. Interestingly enough, it's still 500 million women who are illiterate, but of course there are lots more of us here. So we have made progress. The Millennium Development Goals helped, and certainly the Sustainable Development Goals are working.
The Millennium Development Goals, just to remind people, those are the goals that were set in the year 2000 for a 15-year cycle of development.
Great, and which had a strong focus on education, which helped make progress in countries. But as of today, we still have about 15 million girls of primary school age who will not make it to school compared with 10 million boys who are not in school. So girls are still lagging behind in some progress. Then you have situations, say, in the Caribbean, where educational outcomes for girls and women are very good, but then these outcomes do not necessarily lead to good jobs.
So again, that just shows that that in order to really fundamentally change the opportunities for women, you've got to really look at a sort of quiet revolution, a slow revolution throughout the whole of society and sort of national economies as well, to try and truly create an equal playing field.
You need legal frameworks, you need policies that have the aim to achieve equality. One of the issues that in the tape we heard did not come up, which has been very visible since, is the issue of violence against women.
When did that first become an important factor?
Well, I think the women's movement started talking about violence against women starting in the late 60s, 70s. Remember, we had to tell people that domestic violence, violence in the household, in the family,
was wrong.
Is wrong. It took us till the year 2000 that the Security Council discussed for the very first time the impact of armed conflict on women and girls. And one of the most horrific impacts is violence against women.
I mean, why do you think it took so long for it to get onto the table?
Male delegates here at the UN discussing priorities at the national and global level. And for a long time, we were keeping the private and the public very separate. And so what happened in the family was not being discussed. And I think that's an example of very clear progress. But as you see here in the U.S., for example, through the Me Too movement, what we are seeing right now, that women who come out and say, this has happened to me, whether it's in the movies or in my office space or in sports, it is happening and the discussion is changing. There's one issue that I'd like to raise that I think came up in the tape also. The work that women do in the home. The longest time we have taken it for granted that women do this work. This work is not measured, is not valued. It doesn't show up in national statistical systems, although there are some changes. And the reality is that the work that women do unpaid limits their opportunities to do other things, participate, run for politics, go out and have a paid job.
Yeah. Be in public life. In any capacity.
Public. And this is a new promising debate that has gotten a lot more attention, and there's more of a discussion of what is the responsibility of governments to support households in terms of infrastructure. If there are no childcare facilities or elder care facilities, women risk becoming the default solution. But if we think of societies
of the collective responsibilities and see the constraints that women have in participating in political life, in the economy, and take measures to develop public services, then...
That can support them.
We can support them, and women can engage much more actively in discussions, whether we discuss climate change, peace negotiations, or macroeconomic policies. Women can be at the table. A greater diversity of voices will also lead to a greater pool of solutions. So we will all benefit.
Do you think that if some of the women that we've just heard were kind of around the table here now with us, do you think that they'd be sort of surprised or and generally pleased with the progress that's been made? Or do you think there are things where they would perhaps wonder what went wrong?
I do think they would be pleased to see the progress made, but they would also recognize some of the problems they raised themselves. They would see, they would look...
They wouldn't be surprised if they hadn't yet been solved.
Yes. They would look into parliaments and see, oh, they're still not 50% women. Or if we were to tell them that we still have a gender pay gap, they would say, oh, you still haven't resolved that? But they would also be surprised that we have tackled issues that they didn't discuss at the time. As we mentioned, violence against women, the whole issue of unpaid care work.
And just to sort of move on to what your own personal reaction was in terms of listening to that tape, did it make you think about how your own feminism evolved?
Yes, it made me think of how important it was throughout my life to make women visible, to recognize the achievements of women. I've heard the story in different variations, whether it's with Maggie Thatcher or other women leaders, where you have two kids playing with each other, and the boy says, oh, when I grow up, I'll be prime minister. And the girl says, no, you can't, because that's a woman's job. And of course, if you have role models, you can aspire to think big for yourself. If you're told as a little girl, no, you can't do this because women don't run countries, women don't run big corporations, women can't do certain sports, it limits the potential of people. And I think the biggest change I have seen that barriers for women have fallen in my lifetime. While I'm aware that there are still countries in the world where women might need the permission of a husband to go and see a doctor or to buy property, those examples are becoming fewer and fewer. I mean, back in the mid-70s, women in Europe or the US needed a husband to get a credit card or open a bank account.
We forget just how simple things like that really have changed for the better.
Yes. Some achievements are fairly recent, even in countries that think of themselves as leaders in gender equality issues. No?
And as you say, in terms of things like the battle for reproductive rights, there's a great danger that things can go back, can regress very, very fast.
You still have tensions between breaking pathways for women to enjoy all their rights and to fulfill their potential, and tendencies to control women, to limit their own control of their bodies, but also the control of their minds and their ability to participate in their societies.
So we all have to be vigilant, both men and women.
Correct.
Sylvie Hordosh, thanks so much indeed.
You're welcome.
That's it for this latest podcast classic from UN News, bringing you the highlights from our unique and historic audio archive. You can find more treasures from the vaults by going to www.multimedia.org/AV Library/. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening.
Dear friends, the upheaval caused by the coronavirus, COVID-19, is all around us. And I know many are anxious, worried, and confused, and that's absolutely natural. We are facing a health threat unlike any other in our lifetimes. Meanwhile, the virus is spreading, the danger is growing, and our health systems, economies, and day-to-day lives are being severely tested. The most vulnerable are the most affected, particularly our elderly and those with pre-existing medical conditions, those without access to reliable health care, and those in poverty or living on the edge. The social and economic fallout from the combination of the pandemic and slowing economies will affect most of us for some months. But the spread of the virus will peak, our economies will recover, and until then we must act together to slow the spread of the virus and look after each other. This is a time for prudence, not panic, science, not stigma, facts, not fear. Even though the situation has been classified as a pandemic, it is one we can control. We can slow down transmissions, prevent infections, and save lives. But that will take unprecedented personal, national, and international action. We must declare war on this virus. And that means countries have a responsibility to gear up, step up, and scale up. By implementing effective containment strategies, by activating and enhancing emergency response systems, by dramatically increasing testing capacity and care for patients, by readying hospitals, ensuring they have the space, supplies, and needed personnel, and by developing life-saving medical interventions. And all of us have a responsibility, too, to follow medical advice and take simple, practical steps recommended by health authorities. In addition to being a public health crisis, the virus is infecting the global economy. Financial markets have been hard hit by the uncertainty. Global supply chains have been disrupted. Investment and consumer demand have plunged, with a real rising risk of a global recession. United Nations economists estimate that the virus could cost the global economy at least $1 trillion this year, and perhaps more. No country can do it alone. More than ever, governments must cooperate to revitalize economies, expand public investment, boost trade, and ensure targeted support for the people and communities most affected by the disease or more vulnerable to the negative economic impacts, including women, who often shoulder a disproportionate burden of care work. Dear friends, a pandemic drives home the essential interconnectedness of our human family. Preventing the further spread of COVID-19 is a shared responsibility for us all. The United Nations, including the World Health Organization, is fully mobilized. As part of our human family, we are working 24/7 with governments, providing international guidance, helping the world take on this threat. We stand in full solidarity with you. We are in this together, and we will get through this together. Thank you.
I'm going to read you the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the preamble. Whereas recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. Whereas disregard and contempt for human rights have resulted in barbarous acts which have outraged the conscience of mankind, and the advent of a world in which human beings shall enjoy freedom of speech and belief and freedom from fear and want has been proclaimed as the highest aspiration of the common people. Whereas it is essential, if man is not to be compelled to have recourse as a last resort to rebellion against tyranny and oppression, that human rights should be protected by the rule of law. Whereas it is essential to promote the development of friendly relations between nations. Whereas the peoples of the United Nations have in the Charter reaffirmed their faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, and in the equal rights of men and women, and have determined to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom. Whereas member states have pledged themselves to achieve, in cooperation with the United Nations, the promotion of universal respect for and observance of human rights and fundamental freedoms, whereas a common understanding of these rights and freedoms is of the greatest importance for the full realization of this pledge. Now, therefore, the General Assembly proclaims this Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a common standard of achievement for all peoples and all nations,
to the end that every individual and every organ of society, keeping this declaration constantly in mind, shall strive by teaching and education to promote respect for these rights and freedoms, and by progressive measures, national and international, to secure their universal and effective recognition and observance, both among the peoples of member states themselves and among the peoples of territories under their jurisdiction. Article 1. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. Article 2. Everyone is entitled to all the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration, without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, property, birth, or other status. Furthermore, no distinction shall be made on the basis of the political, jurisdictional, or international status of the country or territory to which a person belongs, whether it be independent, trust, non-self-governing, or under any other limitation of sovereignty. Article 3. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person. Article 4. No one shall be held in slavery or servitude. Slavery and the slave trade shall be prohibited in all their forms. Article 5. No one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. Article 6. Everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. Article 7. All are equal before the law and are entitled without any discrimination to equal protection of the law. All are entitled to equal protection against any discrimination in violation of this declaration and against any incitement to such discrimination. Article 8. Everyone has the right to an effective remedy by the competent national tribunals for acts violating the fundamental rights granted him by the Constitution or by law. Article 9. No one shall be subjected to arbitrary arrest, detention, or exile. Article 10. Everyone is entitled in full equality to a fair and public hearing by an independent and impartial tribunal in the determination of his rights and obligations and of any criminal charge against him. Article 11. 1. Everyone charged with a penal offense has the right to be presumed innocent until proved guilty according to law in a public trial, at which he has had all the guarantees necessary for his defense. 2. No one shall be held guilty of any penal offense on account of any act or omission which did not constitute a penal offense under national or international law at the time when it was committed, nor shall a heavier penalty be imposed than the one that was applicable at the time the penal offense was committed. Article 12. No one shall be subjected to arbitrary interference with his privacy, family, home, or correspondence, nor to attacks upon his honor and reputation. Everyone has the right to the protection of the law against such interference or attacks. Article 13. 1. Everyone has the right to freedom of movement and residence within the borders of each state. 2. Everyone has the right to leave any country, including his own, and to return to his country. Article 14. 1. Everyone has the right to seek and to enjoy in other countries asylum from persecution. 2. This right may not be invoked in the case of prosecutions genuinely arising from non-political crimes or from acts contrary to the purposes and principles of the United Nations. Article 15. 1. Everyone has the right to a nationality. 2. No one shall be arbitrarily deprived of his nationality nor denied the right to change his nationality. Article 16. 1. Men and women of full age, without any limitation due to race, nationality, or religion, have the right to marry and to found a family. They are entitled to equal rights as to marriage, during marriage, and at its dissolution. 2. Marriage shall be entered into only with the free and full consent of the intending spouses. 3. The family is the natural and fundamental group unit of society and is entitled to protection by society and the state. Article 17.1. Everyone has the right to own property alone as well as in association with others. 2. No one shall be arbitrarily deprived of his property. Article 18. Everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change his religion or belief, and freedom, either alone or in community with others, and in public or private, to manifest his religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance. Article 19. Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference, and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. Article 21. Everyone has the right to freedom of peaceful assembly and association. 2. No one may be compelled to belong to an association. Article 21.1. Everyone has the right to take part in the government of his country directly or through freely chosen representatives. 2. Everyone has the right of equal access to public service in his country. 3. The will of the people shall be the basis of the authority of government. This will shall be expressed in periodic and genuine elections, which shall be by universal and equal suffrage, and shall be held by secret vote or by equivalent free voting procedures. Article 22. Everyone, as a member of society, has the right to social security and is entitled to realization through national effort and international cooperation and in accordance with the organization and resources of each state of the economic, social, and cultural rights indispensable for his dignity and the free development of his personality. Article 23.1. Everyone has the right to work, to free choice of employment, to just and favorable conditions of work, and to protection against unemployment. 2. Everyone, without any discrimination, has the right to equal pay for equal work. 3. Everyone who works has the right to just and favorable remuneration, ensuring for himself and his family an existence worthy of human dignity, and supplemented, if necessary, by other means of social protection. 4. Everyone has the right to form and to join trade unions for the protection of his interests. Article 24. Everyone has the right to rest and leisure, including reasonable limitations of working hours and periodic holidays with pay. Article 25.1. Everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and of his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control. 2. Motherhood and childhood are entitled to special care and assistance. All children, whether born in or out of wedlock, shall enjoy the same social protection. Article 26.1. Everyone has the right to education. Education shall be free, at least in the elementary and fundamental stages. Elementary education shall be compulsory. Technical and professional education shall be made generally available, and higher education shall be equally accessible to all on the basis of merit. 2. Education shall be directed to the full development of the human personality and to the strengthening of respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. It shall promote understanding, tolerance, and friendship among all nations, racial or religious groups, and shall further the activities of the United Nations for the maintenance of peace. 3. Parents have a prior right to choose the kind of education that should be given to their children. Article 27.1. Everyone has the right freely to participate in the cultural life of the community, to enjoy the arts, and to share in scientific advancement and its benefits. 2. Everyone has the right to the protection of the moral and material interests resulting from any scientific, literary, or artistic production of which he is the author. Article 28. Everyone is entitled to a social and international order in which the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration can be fully realized. Article 29.1. Everyone has duties to the community in which alone the free and full development of his personality is possible. 2, in the exercise of his rights and freedoms, everyone shall be subject only to such limitations as are determined by law, solely for the purpose of securing due recognition and respect for the rights and freedoms of others, and of meeting the just requirements of morality, public order, and the general welfare in a democratic society. 3, these rights and freedoms may in no case be exercised contrary to the purposes and principles of the United Nations. Article 30. Nothing in this declaration may be interpreted as implying for any state, group, or person any right to engage in any activity or to perform any act aimed at the destruction of any of the rights and freedoms set forth herein. And this is the end of the declaration.